Welcome to IP Management Voice, the podcast spotlighting leading minds in IP and IP management. This series supports the IP Business Academy's call for subject matter experts to share insights, foster reflection, and strengthen the global IP system. Join the conversation via our newsletter and explore cutting-edge content on D-Plex. The content in this episode, which focuses on the strategic power of design rights, comes from Margot Zula.
You know, the moment you pick up a new device or maybe click on an app icon or even just glance at a really beautifully shaped bottle, what's the first thing that grabs you? Well, more often than not, it's the design, isn't it? It's that sort of subtle art of visual innovation. It shapes our whole experience, guides our choices, and, well, it fearfully differentiates products in today's, you know, super crowded market. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the often underestimated yet incredibly powerful world of design rights. Our mission is to go beyond the basics. We're going to uncover what makes design rights such a potent strategic tool, explore smart protection strategies, optimize costs, and reveal the absolute power of combining them with other intellectual property, other IP, to build a truly robust defense around visual innovation. Let's unpack this.
That's right. And it's so important because for any company today, really, from startups right up to global giants, how a product looks is almost as critical as how it functions, sometimes more so initially. Design rights are a fundamental strategic asset. They're not just some legal formality you tick off a list. They're really about securing that unique visual DNA that makes a product instantly recognizable and crucially protected from imitation.
Okay, so we often discuss patents for, you know, innovative functions and trademarks for brand identity. Where do design rights fit into that whole IP landscape? What's maybe often misunderstood about their unique power?
Well, the key distinction, and it's a really important one, is that design rights are purely about the aesthetic appearance, the whole look and feel of an article, or even just parts of it. They safeguard that visual distinctiveness, not the technical function. That's patent territory.
Huh.
Think of it this way. A patent might protect the groundbreaking internal mechanics of, say, a smart home thermostat. Really clever tech inside. But design rights would protect its sleek, minimalist casing, maybe the intuitive layout of its digital display, or even the unique typeface used for its screen interface, the visual elements.
Got it.
And this scope can be incredibly broad. It's not just physical products. Yes, it certainly covers three-dimensional features like, you know, the distinctive contour of a car body or the ergonomic shape of a smartphone. But it also applies to two-dimensional things like intricate patterns on textiles or graphic prints on packaging. And maybe surprisingly for some, it extends right into the digital realm. Things like distinctive app icons, original typography, and crucially for software companies, the visual layout and aesthetic of graphical user interfaces, or GUIs.
GUI, so the whole look and feel of a screen display.
Exactly. The entire aesthetic of that interface.
So it's not just the physical thing you hold, but potentially the entire user experience, from the object itself right through to its digital interface. That's a much wider scope than many might realize.
Precisely. Let's imagine a hypothetical company, maybe Artitech, developing that smart home thermostat we mentioned. They've patented the core technology, the clever stuff inside. But to truly own their innovation, they'd also seriously consider protecting the unique design of the device itself, its housing, perhaps its unique mounting plate, and even the visual arrangement of their companion app's interface, maybe the specific look of their little eco mode icon. This kind of multifaceted approach is really critical.
Okay, that makes sense. But that brings us to what can't be protected. If design rights are so broad, where are the lines in the sand? What's definitely out?
Yeah, there are clear boundaries. You generally can't protect features that are solely dictated by technical function. If a product must look a certain way simply to perform its job, like, say, a standard screw head.
Right. It has to be that shape to work with a screwdriver.
Exactly. It generally won't qualify for design protection. The key test here is often, could it have been designed differently to achieve the same function? If the answer is yes, then that aesthetic choice can potentially be protected. Also excluded are what we call features of interconnection designs that must be reproduced exactly for mechanical connection. Think of the shape of a USB-C plug. It has to be that shape to connect.
To ensure things work together, interoperability makes sense.
Right. And fundamentally, design rights protect a specific visual manifestation, not just abstract ideas or concepts. You can't protect the idea of a sleek thermostat, only the specific look of your sleek thermostat.
Got it. So it's about a concrete, unique visual form, which leads us to the crucial question. What makes a design truly registrable? It's not enough just to draw something new, is it? There are criteria it has to meet.
Absolutely not. There are two fundamental requirements that really stand out: novelty and individual character. Novelty simply means no identical design has been made publicly available anywhere in the world before your filing date, or priority date if you claim one.
Anywhere in the world. Wow.
Yes, it's a global standard. A single prior disclosure, even just showing it at a small trade fair somewhere, can potentially destroy novelty worldwide. Now, the crucial insight for companies here, especially in Europe, is the 12-month grace period in the EU. This allows a designer's own disclosure, like maybe testing the waters with a soft launch, to not immediately destroy novelty for an EU registration.
Oh, that's useful. Bit of breathing room.
It is, but relying solely on grace periods in one jurisdiction can be risky, because it might mean you've lost protection possibilities in other countries that don't have such a generous grace period. So the gold standard, the safest global strategy, is always proactive filing before any public disclosure.
Okay, file first, talk later. Got it. What about the second requirement, individual character?
Right, individual character. This one's often more nuanced. It means the overall visual impression your design produces on something called an informed user must genuinely differ from any existing design already out there.
An informed user, who's that exactly? Uh-huh. Not just anyone off the street?
No, not an average consumer, but also not necessarily a technical expert. Think of someone who really knows their stuff in that particular product sector. They're attentive to detail, knowledgeable about the common designs in that field, and importantly, they're able to make direct comparisons. They wouldn't be easily fooled by just minor tweaks.
Right.
So for our Artitech thermostat, this means its aesthetic has to genuinely stand out to someone familiar with thermostats, maybe an installer, or a keen smart home user compared to all the other thermostats on the market. It can't just be a slight variation. The overall impression needs to be different.
That's a lot to consider. Balancing that novelty requirement with creating a truly distinct impression for someone who knows the field.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's say design clears these hurdles. It's novel. It has individual character. Now, the real strategic puzzle begins, right? What exactly do you protect? The whole product, just a crucial part, or maybe even a tiny signature detail. How do companies, like our Artitech example, navigate these choices for maximum impact?
This is really where strategy becomes paramount, and each approach has distinct pros and cons. Let's break it down. If Artitech decides to protect the whole product, their entire smart thermostat unit, they get comprehensive coverage against someone basically cloning its overall form factor. This is powerful, especially if the entire design is iconic and really central to their brand identity.
That's good. What's the catch?
Well, the downside is it can be vulnerable to clever design arounds. Competitors might make minor alterations to various different elements, change the curve here, adjust a button there, creating enough collective differences to potentially avoid infringement while still sort of mimicking the overall successful look.
Death by a thousand small changes.
Something like that. So then there's the option of protecting specific parts of a product. Imagine Artitech has a particularly innovative, maybe modular base for their thermostat that allows it to attach easily to various surfaces in a unique way. Protecting just that base design provides really targeted defense for a highly distinctive component that someone might want to copy independently, maybe for their own thermostat.
Right. Protect the crown jewel, so to speak.
Exactly. This approach is also quite resilient. If the overall product design evolves over time, the base might stay the same through several generations, and it can be stronger against partial infringement. The trade-off, well, it doesn't protect the overall impression of the whole device, and you might end up needing multiple filings if you have several distinct parts on a complex product.
Okay, whole product, specific parts.
Yeah.
What's the third option?
The third level is protecting specific aesthetic details. This is for those real signature elements where even a small visual cue screams your brand. Think of a unique stitching pattern on a luxury handbag, or perhaps a very distinct texture applied to Artitech's device casing, or maybe a particular button shape, or even an icon design.
Super specific.
Very specific. The advantage is highly targeted protection against attempts to retain those key aesthetic identifiers, even in a different overall design. But the challenge here is the very limited scope. It's potentially the easiest to design around just by making minor changes to that detail, and enforcement can be tricky if that tiny detail appears within a significantly different overall product.
Wow, okay. So for our listeners navigating these choices, maybe with their own innovations, it sounds like really understanding your competitive landscape, anticipating how competitors might try to copy you. It's almost like playing a game of chess, isn't it?
Absolutely. It demands a really systematic framework. Beyond just looking at competitors, a detailed cost-benefit analysis is crucial. You have to balance the filing and, importantly, the ongoing maintenance costs against the actual strength and breadth of protection you're achieving with each approach. You also need a clear enforcement strategy in mind from the start. How will the scope you choose now impact your ability to take legal action down the road? And think about flexibility and future-proofing. Will this design protection remain relevant as your product naturally evolves? These aren't just legal questions. They're fundamental business strategy decisions.
Right. It's deeply tied into the business goals.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the strategic roadmap for what to protect. Now, let's get practical. How do companies ensure they're being cost-efficient with their design rights, especially if they're operating across multiple countries, maybe even globally, without compromising that protection?
That's a critical challenge, absolutely. And thankfully, there are some really powerful mechanisms available, especially when looking at Europe and internationally. For Europe, the big one is the European Union Registered Community Design, usually just called the RCD.
RCD, okay.
It's basically a unified system. A single application filed with the UIPO grants protection across all 27 EU member states. Imagine for Arda Tech launching their smart thermostat across Europe.
Huge simplification.
Huge. It dramatically reduces the administrative burden and, of course, the costs compared to filing separate national applications in, say, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and so on. And the RCD also offers what's called a multiple application system. This allows you to bundle numerous designs, maybe different color variations of the thermostat or its packaging design or those app icons we mentioned, into just one application, provided they're in the same product class. This significantly lowers the per design cost.
Bundling sounds very efficient.
It is.
Hey, are you an IP expert with a focus topic you want to share? Then you might be just the right fit to become an IP subject matter expert at the IP Business Academy. It's a great opportunity to build visibility for your expertise and reach new clients through a trusted academic platform. You'll be supported in creating digital content, LinkedIn strategies, and outreach to your target group. If you're ready to raise your profile and position yourself as a thought leader, get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. End of advertisement.
And here's another really strategic feature, deferred publication. Arda Tech could file their RCD application, securing their filing date, but request that the publication of the design be deferred for up to 30 months.
30 months? Wow, why would you do that?
It's fantastic for flexibility. It allows you to keep the design secret, perhaps while you finalize manufacturing or conduct market testing or coordinate a global launch. You get the priority date locked in, but you control when the design becomes public knowledge. It buys you strategic time while still providing provisional rights.
That deferred publication sounds incredibly valuable for market timing and strategy. But what if Arda Tech, maybe early on, only needs protection in, say, Germany, or perhaps a few non-EU countries like Switzerland or the UK now? Does the RCD still make sense then?
Not always, no. In those cases, national design applications are the way to go. They're perfect when your market interest is really confined to just one specific country, or maybe when a particular national law offers some specific advantage you want to leverage. And, as you mentioned, they're essential for complementing the RCD by covering important non-EU European countries like Switzerland, Norway, or the UK, which aren't part of the unified EU system. For instance, the UK has its unregistered design right, which is automatic, quick, and costs nothing up front. But it offers a more limited scope and duration compared to a registered right. Germany's system is known for being quite straightforward and cost-effective for national registration, too. It's about tailoring the approach.
Right, choosing the right tool for the specific market.
Okay,
and then for the bigger picture, multinational corporations, or if Arda Tech suddenly hits the big time and wants to go global, how do they protect designs worldwide without completely breaking the bank?
For broad international protection, the key mechanism is the Hague system for the International Registration of Industrial Designs. This is administered by WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization.
The Hague system.
Yeah.
Like an international passport for designs.
That's a great way to think about it. Arda Tech could file one single international application in one language, pay one set of fees, and designate protection in multiple member countries, currently over 90 territories, including major markets like the US, Japan, South Korea, Canada, the UK, the EU itself, and many others.
One application for potentially dozens of countries.
Exactly. It massively reduces the administrative complexity and the costs compared to filing individual applications in each of those countries separately. It centralizes management to renewals, changes of ownership. It's all handled through WIPO, and it offers potentially rapid global protection, which is vital for coordinating simultaneous international product launches. Like the RCD, it also offers a deferred publication option, typically up to 30 months. Generally speaking, if you're seeking protection in, say, more than 3 to 5 Hague member countries, the Hague system usually becomes significantly more cost-effective than going the national route everywhere.
That sounds incredibly efficient for global players.
Yeah.
So beyond these specific systems, RCD, National, Hague, are there any sort of universal best practices companies should adopt to really optimize costs across their entire design portfolio?
Oh, absolutely. Several key things. The first, and maybe the most important, is proactive design searches and strategic planning. Before you even think about filing, conduct thorough searches for prior art existing designs and also freedom to operate, or FTO searches.
FTO. Checking you don't accidentally step on someone else's rights.
Precisely. Doing this before you invest heavily in finalizing a design and filing applications prevents wasting significant resources on designs that ultimately aren't novel or might land you in legal trouble later. It also helps you prioritize which designs are most commercially important and actually worth protecting. Secondly, targeted selection of protection territories is key. Avoid the temptation of just filing everywhere just in case. Focus your budget on your primary sales markets, countries where you manufacture, or perhaps where your key competitors are based. Be strategic about where you spend.
Makes sense. Don't spread yourself too thin.
Right. And thirdly, actively leverage those bundling options we talked about, the multiple application features within the RCD and the Hague system. Group related designs together in single applications whenever possible to get those economies of scale. And finally, don't underestimate the value of integrated IP management. Engage experienced IP attorneys early in the design process, not just at the filing stage. And consider using digital IP management software tools to help track deadlines, manage renewals, and keep costs under control. It's about being smart and organized from concept all the way through to launch and beyond.
Fantastic advice. So we've talked about building these individual walls of protection with design rights, and we've explored how to make them strong but also cost-effective. But the strongest defense, as we often hear in IP, comes from a truly integrated fortress, right? How do design rights act as a crucial piece in that broader IP puzzle when you combine them with other types of intellectual property?
This is really where you unlock the maximum potential. You build a truly multi-layered, synergistic, protective umbrella around your innovations. Let's start with the obvious pairing: design rights and trademarks. As we touched on, trademarks protect who made the product, the brand name, the logos, maybe a slogan. They're source identifiers. Design rights, on the other hand, protect what the product looks like, its specific aesthetic appearance.
Complementary roles.
Exactly. They work hand in hand. Trademarks prevent others from using confusingly similar branding, while design rights stop them from copying the product's distinctive visual form, even if they use different branding. And sometimes they overlap beautifully. Think of the classic Coca-Cola bottle. Its unique contoured shape was initially protected by design rights for its aesthetic form. That protection has a finite term, usually up to 25 years in many places. But crucially, that same distinctive shape has also become so iconic that it functions as a trademark, a three-dimensional shape mark. It tells you instantly who made the drink, right?
Absolutely. Instantly recognizable.
And trademark protection for a shape like that can potentially last indefinitely, as long as it continues to function as a source identifier in the minds of consumers. So you get this powerful dual protection. It enhances deterrence, gives you stronger enforcement options, and significantly increases the overall asset value of that design.
That's a powerful example of that synergy.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do design rights play with patent rights?
Yeah.
The ones that are all about function.
Again, they are distinct but highly complementary, especially for products where both innovative functionality and an appealing design are critical to success, which is most consumer products today, really. Patents protect the technical inventions, how something works, the clever mechanism inside, what it does. Design rights focus purely on the aesthetic, non-functional aspects, how it looks. Let's go back to Artitech's smart thermostat. It's internal technology, maybe it's AI learning algorithm or its unique sensor array that's protected by utility patents. Simultaneously, its sleek exterior design, maybe those minimalist rounded corners, the specific placement of buttons, the aspect ratio of the screen that's protected by design rights.
Form meets function. protected separately but together.
Precisely. This holistic approach means you're protecting both the functional superiority and the visual appeal that attracts customers in the first place. It also helps prevent competitors from designing around your patent. Maybe they figure out a different technical way to achieve the same function, but if they still copy your successful look, your design rights can stop them. It ensures you protect the innovation comprehensively.
That makes a lot of sense. So if patents cover the technical side, and trademarks cover the brand, and design rights cover the look, what about copyrights? Where do they fit into this picture, if at all?
Ah, copyrights. This relationship can be a bit more nuanced, especially depending on the country. In many European jurisdictions, there's this concept called cumulation of protection, where a single design can actually enjoy both design law protection and copyright protection simultaneously if it meets the requirements for both.
So potentially double coverage?
Potentially, yes. Copyright protects original artistic works automatically the moment they're created, usually without needing registration. So it can provide a kind of baseline layer of protection, especially for designs that have a strong artistic character. Think of maybe unique sculptural furniture or very original graphic icons, or perhaps a highly distinctive artistic pattern Artitech might use on its packaging.
Automatic protection sounds good. Why bother registering the design then?
Well, relying solely on copyright for design protection has drawbacks. Registered designs offer significant advantages. They provide a much clearer, defined scope of protection. You know exactly what's covered from the registration documents. They also benefit from a presumption of validity, meaning the burden of proof shifts to the challenger. And generally, enforcing a registered design right is more straightforward and often stronger in court than relying on unregistered copyright for an industrial product.
I see. So copyright is maybe a safety net, but registration gives you clarity and strength.
That's a good way to put it. While automatic copyright protection is valuable, for high-value, commercially important designs, actively pursuing registered design protection, potentially alongside copyright, if applicable, is usually the most prudent strategy. It creates that extra layer of defense and legal clarity.
It really feels like you're building this robust fortress around innovation, using different materials, patents, trademarks, designs, maybe copyright, not just relying on a single wall. It's truly a multi-pronged approach, anticipating different ways someone might try to copy or undermine your work.
Exactly. That's the goal. For corporations, building that comprehensive IP portfolio isn't just a nice to have. It's really a strategic imperative. It starts with a thorough assessment of each product. What are its key functional innovations? What are its defining aesthetic features? What are the crucial branding elements? Then comes prioritization. Allocating your IP budget based on commercial value, how easy something might be to imitate, and its importance in key markets. And you need to actively look for and minimize any protection gaps, ensuring all valuable aspects are covered to prevent competitors from finding and exploiting a weakness. And this really requires integrated IP management. It means having your cross-functional teams, R&D, design, marketing, legal, collaborating closely right from the earliest stages of product development, ensuring everyone understands the value of IP and works together to protect it effectively, maximizing the value you capture from every single innovation.
Wow. What an incredibly insightful deep dive into the world of design rights. We've really journeyed from understanding their unique scope and power through making smart strategic choices about what and how to protect, optimizing those costs, and finally seeing the immense power of combining them with other forms of IP for maximum defense. It's crystal clear that in our visually driven world, understanding and strategically leveraging design rights isn't just some legal formality, it's a fundamental core business advantage.
Absolutely. It's not just about legal compliance, although that's important too. It's fundamentally about achieving market differentiation, enhancing your brand value, protecting your R&D investment, and ultimately ensuring sustained commercial success. It's about securing your visual identity and maintaining that crucial competitive edge.
So a final thought for everyone listening. As you go about your day-to-day, start really looking at the products you interact with. Your phone, your coffee cup, the layout of the website you're browsing or the app you're using. Next time you pick up a beautifully designed product, don't just admire its looks. Ask yourself, what strategic choices might have gone into protecting that specific visual innovation? How many layers of IP design rights, trademarks, maybe patents are likely guarding its aesthetic identity? And what does that tell you about the company's foresight, their long-term vision, and their competitive strategy? Start seeing the world through the lens of design protection. It's everywhere.
Thanks for listening to IP Management Voice. If there's any topic you'd like us to cover in this podcast or on the content platform Dplex, please get in contact and let us know.